I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with a former priest determined to learn his church's role in anti-Semitism. His bestseller, Constantine's Sword, is now a film. But first, in an email to supporters today, Senator Hillary Clinton said it was time to rally behind Senator Barack Obama. Clinton plans to effectively end her historic bid for the White House on Saturday. Meanwhile, Senator Obama has set up a three-person committee, including JFK's daughter, Caroline Kennedy, to head a vice presidential search committee. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell has been one of Hillary Clinton's strongest supporters. He joins us now. And Governor, do you support the idea of Clinton as VP?
Well, first of all, I think that's up to Senator Obama, first and foremost, and Senator Clinton. And I think the way that this gets resolved is for the two of them to sit down, spend some significant time together, talking about the campaign and the various roles, talking about what a Obama-Clinton administration would look like, how they'd parse out the work. Would Senator Clinton get, for example, health care as her portfolio? If they can reach agreement, if they feel comfortable with each other, then I think it's by far the strongest ticket we could feel and something that I would be strongly in favor of.
First of all, has that happened yet? Are they sitting face-to-face without aides? Or?
No, not yet.
Yep.
And it has to be without aides. No staffs, no strategic advisors, no senior advisors, no surrogates.
Well, you've said that would be a wonderful ticket, but you've also said there's downsides that, Obama has been a candidate who stood for change and Clinton represents, a past administration.
Well, sure, but she also represents changing the way America provides health care for its citizens. She also represents changing the way we do energy in this country. She also represents changing our economy and, for the first time, having an infrastructure repair program on a strong significant level.
It sounds like you're still campaigning for her, Governor.
Well, it's going to take me a while. I'm going to go into the decompression chamber. But it is the truth. I mean, it depends what you're talking about. Change. Are we changing personalities, or are we changing the direction of the country?
Well, you said on the Today Show today that if you were asked to take the vice presidency, you wouldn't. You're a number one guy, not the number two guy. It was very refreshing. But some might say, isn't she also the number one guy?
To a degree, I think that's correct. I think that would, when I say they both have to be comfortable, first and foremost, Senator Obama has to be comfortable with Senator Clinton as a running mate and prospectively working together for 8 years. But conversely, Senator Clinton has to decide whether she'd be comfortable in the last analysis, having input, significant input, but in the last analysis, doing what President Obama would say, doing what candidate Obama would say. Mm. And I can't speak for Hillary on that, and that's a difficult thing. I know for me it would be very, very hard to work for someone else.
What about the fact that Hillary Clinton is not conceding? She's suspending her campaign, meaning that she'll still have control over her delegates. Is that a good thing for the party? I mean, wouldn't it be more gracious on Saturday for her to release all of her superdelegates and thoroughly back Barack Obama?
Well, she is going to thoroughly back Barack Obama. I think the reason she's doing that has to do more with federal election campaign fundraising law. If you terminate your campaign, you're given a very short window to pay off your debt. And she hasn't necessarily said she isn't going to release delegates as they go down. And by the way, it's not just superdelegates. Under the law, pledged delegates are free to vote for anybody they want, and she could release her pledged delegates as well. But nobody who has run for election can understand the bond that you develop between the people who are supporting you, the people who give you those $10 and $25 contributions, the people who lick envelopes, the people who knock on doors. And for those people, they may want to see votes cast for Hillary Clinton. As long as she's suspending her campaign and saying she's 100% behind Senator Obama, I think it's not a major issue.
And Governor, one last question. I remember a moment very clearly in the campaign where you said, as a representative of your state, that Barack Obama could not win in your state. Clinton did beat Obama by 200,000 votes in your state. What can he do, briefly, to win over those voters?
Well, I want to be clear. I never said that Senator Obama couldn't win in Pennsylvania. I said he'd have much more trouble winning than Senator Clinton would, but I said always that I thought he could carry this state, and he's got to go and say, look, here's what I plan to do about reviving the American economy. Here's what I plan to do about helping American families who are straining under the load of increasing gas prices, increasing electricity prices, increasing food prices. Here's my plan. Look at my plan compared to the Republican plan, and it's much better for you. For women voters, for the diehard women voters, he's got to go to them and say, look, on women's issues, family issues, child care, health care, I'm so much more in step with what you believe in than Senator McCain is. And think about the Supreme Court. The next president will appoint at least 3 Supreme Court justices and will set the tenor of the court for the next 25 years. And you don't want someone appointing judges who says that Justice Alito and Justice Roberts are perfect judges for the type he'd like to appoint. And that's what Senator McCain has said. So he's got to make those arguments to those constituencies, and we're going to help him.
Ed Rendell, Democratic governor of Pennsylvania, on a cell phone from his car. Governor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Remember this old Lenny Bruce routine? Dustin Hoffman played the brilliant comic on film.
I'm Jewish. Now, a Jew, dictionary style, is one who is descended from one of the ancient tribes of Judea, or one who is regarded to have descended from that tribe. But you and I know what a Jew really is. One who killed our Lord.
But they didn't. Pagan Romans did. And that truth is at the heart of the new film Constantine's Sword, based on the book of the same name by former Roman Catholic priest and Boston Globe columnist James Carroll, who set out to find out the truth about his beloved church's role in the history of anti-Semitism. And Jim joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be here.
Also joining us is Oren Jacoby. He produced, directed, and co-wrote Constantine's Sword. Oren, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be here.
And James Carroll, let's start with you. You're a father now, a husband, a practicing Catholic, a former priest, as we said. We follow you on this journey across the U.S., through Europe, back in time. What were you looking for?
I'm of the generation of Catholics who were born into the church believing in its perfection. There was a pope not long ago in the late 19th century who actually defined the church as a perfect society. I was born with an innate love of the Catholic Church. I still deeply feel that. But what I was looking for in this journey was an explanation to account for the shocking recognitions that I came to as a young man, which recognition was tied especially to the failures of the Church during the Holocaust. How could this mystical body of Christ have so grievously failed in the great moral test of the 20th century? And that question opened up the whole way in which religion itself is a source across the globe of intolerance, hatred, and even violence. Mm. This journey seeks to reckon with those questions.
What people do in the name of God. And you are a child who grew up, I mean, your parents were Mary and Joseph.
Yeah.
Your initials are J.C.
Yeah.
Tell us what the cross meant to you.
The first powerful impact on my imagination, I would say, was the cross itself. I remember as a very young child kneeling before the cross in church. The agonized body of Jesus gripped me. The cross was a sign of mercy, a sign of God's love, the Son of God dying for us, for me. So it really grounds me in my basic conviction in the goodness and mercifulness of not just God, but of life.
And as Oren shows in the film, you saw the cross in everything, in telephone poles, in airplanes.
That's true, and I still do. I have a kind of, the cross is an orienting symbol in my imagination. And it's. But then again, of course, the cross is also the crosshairs. It's the thing that people use to sight weapons. And that's what happened to me. There was a flip that took place where I saw the cross itself as having had terribly negative effects down through history. I began to see the cross from the point of view of people who had learned to dread the sight of it, who were afraid of it. And of course, in European history, that was overwhelmingly Jews. Today, that includes Muslims. The word crusade, which President Bush accidentally used to define this present war, means the war of the cross. And when I reckoned with the fact that the cross itself has been a source of violence, It was deeply upsetting to me. And it's deeply upsetting, I would say, to every Christian who comes to this. And these days, it's increasingly difficult not to come to it because we are in the middle of a war that the other side would like to define explicitly in religious terms, a war between Islam and Christianity. And therefore, people who are religious, who value the religious traditions, have an obligation to look at the ways in which their traditions are implicated in this.
Well, with Oren, you go on a journey to find out just how it was that the cross was beaten into a sword, so
yes.
to speak. You trace
yeah.
it. And your journey begins in, of all places, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Now, we add more to your biography because, James Carroll, you were the son of a man who became an Air Force general. He was also part of what you call the military nuclear priesthood, provided intelligence during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
That's right.
The lead-up to the war in Vietnam. This is a very powerful military man.
It's true.
And you once wanted to be an aviator. I thought, how interesting, yeah. a priest, an aviator, both
right.
in the heavens.
It's
you know.
True. It's true.
But you go to the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Oren, tell us about that part of the journey. Why the U.S. Air Force Academy?
The day we started production, we read about a rumor of what was happening at the U.S. Air Force Academy, that Colorado Springs is a center for the big evangelical, many of the big evangelical megachurches in the country.
Sure, one that was led by Ted Haggard, who fell from grace when it was revealed that he had a relationship with a male prostitute.
Well, long before that was revealed, he was one of the most powerful religious figures in America. He had a weekly conference call with other evangelical leaders, with the President of the United States. He led a very powerful lobbying group called the National Association of Evangelicals, which, as he says in the film, has 30 million members. And they were making a concerted effort, along with other groups, to influence and have a sort of proselytizing role in the U.S. military. And it was nowhere being more powerfully felt than at the Air Force Academy right next door.
In fact, you both talked to some of the cadets there who are Jewish, and, you know, it's become unbearable for them. Let's listen.
I'd never heard it in high school. If people knew I was Jewish, it never was a point. It never made any kind of mention. But once I got to the academy, I was so aware of it that I was kind of different. I went to lunch. I had a flyer for a movie on my plate, and it was for The Passion of the Christ, and it had all kinds of quotes.
Every single place in Mitchell Hall had
every place setting.
That's 4,000 place settings that each single one had an advertisement for The Passion of the Christ.
Well, that Mel Gibson film that Jewish cadets were forced to watch or encouraged to watch claimed that Jews killed Christ, something James Carroll learned as a child. He'd soon meet scholars who would tell him it was actually pagan Romans, that it was the conqueror Constantine who took up the cross as a symbol of war and conquest in the name of God. Previously, symbols like fish represented the Christian faith. He learned that Jews were targeted and killed or made to convert during the Crusades, during the Inquisition in Spain, and that Jews in Rome were walled off in a ghetto in the shadows of the Vatican decades before the Holocaust. So just ahead, with all of these disappointments, why does this former priest still so deeply love his church? Also, later today, tonight's big game, we'll have that as well, back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from filmmaker Oren Jacoby and writer James Carroll. Their film, Constantine's Sword, traces anti-Semitism through history. Included is the story of Edith Stein, a Jew who converted to Catholicism, becoming a nun. She was said to have written to Pope Pius XI right after Hitler took power. Now, Carroll and Jacoby went in search of that letter, and astonishingly, they found a copy of it at a convent in Germany. Here's an excerpt read by actress Natasha Richardson.
Holy Father, as a child of the Jewish people, who by the grace of God has been for the last 11 years a child of the Roman Catholic Church, I take the liberty to spell out what oppresses millions of Germans. For years on end, Nazi leaders have preached anti-Semitism. Now that they have put their hands on the powers of government, the seeds of hate have sprouted. For weeks now, not only Jews, but thousands of faithful Roman Catholics have been waiting for the church to raise its voice. Isn't the extermination campaign pursued against those of Jewish blood an insult to the most holy humanity of our Redeemer?
Stein's letter was ignored. She was later killed at Auschwitz. Oren Jacoby, your film was based on Jim Carroll's book, Constantine's Sword, but it expands. It discovers things like this incredible letter.
This film is kind of a detective story. It's a new journey where, on faith, we go to these places and we meet a character, and that character gives us another clue and then leads us, you know, ineluctably to the next piece of the story.
It's also a little bit of a psychologist's couch, you know, as you try to examine, you know, this conflict that you have. How have you resolved that? Your love of your faith, your love of God, and your growing awareness that what you were taught in many ways was not true.
Well, I have resolved it because the church itself has enabled me to. That's what's really, from my point of view, kind of glorious about this story. The climax of this story, following the Holocaust, comes for me as a Catholic with the arrival of Pope John the 23rd, whom I was lucky enough to meet as a boy of 17, and it was a defining moment in my life. What John the 23rd did in the late 1950s was declare a Vatican Council, a meeting of every bishop of the Catholic Church in the world, because he understood that the Church, as he put it, needed to open up its windows and needed to reckon with this history. John the 23rd was the one who required the council to take up the question of the Church's relationship with the Jews. What's to take up there? Conservatives asked. He was one of the only Catholic prelates to have actively opposed the Holocaust as it unfolded when he was the papal legate in Turkey. And what he required those bishops to do, they did. And they issued the most important statement, I would argue, in the modern Church. Nostra Aetate, in our time, it means a renunciation forever of this lethal, poisonous Christ-killer charge and an affirmation of the covenant God has made with the Jewish people. No more saying that the Jews are an obsolete people, that their religion is to be rejected. No more saying that the Jews killed Jesus. That, Robin, is a defining revolution. It's the ground of hope going forward between the Jewish and Christian peoples.
But yet you have a reissue of the prayer asking, you know, with the hope that the Jews convert. And also you have the story where you begin at Colorado Springs, an active campaign to vilify and try to, if what these cadets are saying is true. And in fact, the Yale Divinity School did a report on it and found that this is happening, this attempt to convert and vilify Jews at the Air Force Academy, not by Catholics, but by evangelicals.
It's true. So this infection actually involves the whole Christian tradition. This is not just about Roman Catholicism. And the failure in the Holocaust was a broad Christian, Protestant as well as Catholic failure.
In fact, you say the zeal of the Catholics, the early Catholics, passed over onto the Protestants.
Yes, it's true. It's true. And all of this shows how difficult it is to change something so basic as this. The idea that the Christ-killer charge is outmoded and to be let go of now, of course, was contradicted most powerfully by the Mel Gibson film, The Passion of the Christ, which laid the responsibility for the murder of Jesus directly at the feet of the Jews. And it's not an accident that that film was a generating part of what happened at the Air Force Academy. It was when cadets were effectively required to see The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson that this problem at the Air Force Academy began. Christians cannot simply go on remembering the death of Jesus the way it's been remembered for 1,800 years. Christians cannot go on thinking about their access to God as somehow setting them above other religions, because the connection to violence with all of these abstract theological positions has been made so palpably clear.
You mentioned Islam. And you can't help but wonder, as you watch the film, there is no group that despises the Jews more than the radical fundamentalist Islamists.
Yes, it's true.
But you didn't. They're not in your film. Is that because you tend to your garden first?
Well, partly that. I mean, this is an act of Christian self-criticism. So its function is not to say what is wrong with Jewish religion or Islamic religion. It's to talk about the way in which in our tradition we have demonized the other, most powerfully and obviously Jews, but also powerfully, and this is relevant today, Muslims. The Christian tradition of anti-Semitism has spread like a virus, and it has been picked up, caught by segments of Arab Islamic culture. But one of the things to be quite aware of is that there's nothing endemic to the religion of Islam or to certainly the text of the Quran that leads to anti-Semitism. Actually, this has been much more of a Christian problem than a Muslim one. And that's a reason for hope, because if we Christians can get over it, as I think we are struggling to do, then the present-day conflict between some Muslims and Jews can also be resolved.
The film is Constantine's Sword. It's based on the 2001 book of the same name by James Carroll. James Carroll, former Catholic priest, now a columnist, writer for the Boston Globe. We're also joined by Oren Jacoby, who produced, directed, and co-wrote the film. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And in the meantime, thank you both for talking to us about a fascinating film.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
And still ahead today, the state of men's tennis. That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Captain! Mayday, mayday! I think the right wing's just broken off.
Yeah, did it? That's nothing to panic about.
Ah! I think the left one's just broken off as well! Oh, no, what are we going to do?
Oh, don't worry, old chap. We still have a second chance. Oh. Just tell the stewardess it's time to serve the Red Bull.
What?
That's part of an ad for the super-caffeinated energy drink Red Bull, one of the many energy drinks that at least a third of 12 to 24-year-olds say they drink daily and often, according to a recent report in the New York Times, before breakfast. A handful of kids have been hospitalized. One school has banned certain energy drinks, and others are warning parents about them. Tara Parker Pope writes the Well column and blog for the New York Times. Tara, a lot of kids are drinking these.
These are incredibly popular drinks with kids, and not just teens, but younger kids. I think one out of three 12-year-olds is also drinks energy drinks.
Well, and let's differentiate, because there's so many different kinds of drinks out there right now. There's sports drinks like Gatorade, fitness waters that have vitamins or protein, traditional sodas, and then these energy drinks. How much caffeine's in them?
It varies, but a 12-ounce serving of AMP, for instance, which is made by Pepsi,
AMP.
Mm-hmm. It has about 107 milligrams of caffeine. Now, a regular can of Coke or Pepsi, 34 to 38 milligrams. So that's considered a fairly low-level energy drink. You know, Monster and Red Bull, they're at like 115, 120. There's one called Spike Shooter, which has 428 milligrams of caffeine. Mm. There's another one, Wired, X344. Has 258 milligrams of caffeine in a 12-ounce serving. So for coffee drinkers out there, you know, if you order a 12-ounce brewed coffee at Starbucks, it's 250 milligrams. So if you think about you're giving a 10-year-old, you know, a big Starbucks coffee, that's a lot of caffeine.
Well, and as you write, they're not sipping it as they would a cup of coffee. They're throwing them back and getting sick. There's actual cases of kids being sent to the hospital.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really just, you know, they're not used to the caffeine and they feel their heart race or they get nauseous. And some of the teachers at one of these school districts in Oregon sent an email to parents saying, you know, your kids are either completely drunk on caffeine or they're crashing off of caffeine, and either way, it's not good. The caffeine is just one issue, though.
Right. A significant portion of your writing focused on a new study in the Journal of American College Health that links energy drinks to toxic jock behavior.
That alone is just kind of interesting that there's actually a name for this. And that's a more of a jock mentality than an athlete mentality. These kids are high risk takers. They get into fights. They're more likely to be sexually aggressive, drive an unsafe way. It's a real risk-taking mindset, this jock syndrome that they're talking about. And what they've seen is that the type of child that is attracted to these energy drinks, there's an association with that risk-taking behavior. So this may, in fact, be a red flag for parents.
Yeah, it may be a sign that this is a child who may have this kind of behavior, especially when you add this new trend. I mean, kids are mixing these energy drinks with alcohol. A 16-year-old girl from Florida died of cardiac arrest after drinking Red Bull and vodka. Because what is the, you know, extra problem of adding these energy drinks to alcohol?
You feel less drunk and you seem less drunk, and you're still just as drunk as you always were. And they've done this in studies where they've had people consume alcohol and then alcohol and caffeine, and you score just as poorly on your reaction time and all those indicators. But in terms of your own self-perception, you don't feel as woozy. You don't feel as fuzzy because you're hopped up on caffeine, too. You're an awake drunk, as they say. You know, the best thing that can happen to somebody is they drink too much and they fall asleep and they don't get in a car and drive. But if you're stoked up on caffeine, you're going to get behind, more likely to get behind the wheel. And that's what they've seen. The kids who are mixing alcohol and these high caffeine drinks are more likely to get into a car with a drunk driver. They're more likely to be sexually aggressive or victims of sexual aggression. So they're more likely to get into trouble because they've got this added level of sort of energy and awareness, but they're still drunk. And so that makes them more likely to engage in risky behavior.
And it's not just caffeine. It's other stimulants.
There are some other stimulants that, you know, we don't really completely understand. You know, there's vitamins, there's all kinds of herbs. You know, I talked to one researcher who said a lot of parents really don't know what their kids are getting when they're consuming these drinks. And honestly, I don't even know. I look at some of the labels on this stuff and I think, wow, you know, what do we really know about a lot of these ingredients? And when you mix them all together, how stimulating are they? And, you know, are most kids going to drink these drinks and be fine? Of course. But kids who are drinking tons of these drinks and stop are going to get a caffeine withdrawal. They're going to get headaches. And I think there's this a larger concern here that, what are we teaching our kids about performance that you need to take a substance to enhance your performance on the field or at school? It's just the wrong message.
Well, I'm looking at Redline, which is one of the drinks. In addition to caffeine, we read in the McClatchy papers that it has yohimbine, which is a stimulant that's used in treating erectile dysfunction, vinpocetine, which is used in Europe in the treatment of Alzheimer's. Colorado Springs, as you report, after kids got sick from Spike Shooter, the principal banned it. But the American Beverage Association is saying it's buyer beware. It's not their responsibility. They say that energy products are intended for adults only, that some brands even include warning labels on the can saying that drinks are not for people under 18. Reading on the Spike Shooter warning label, it says recommended use begin with one half a can to determine tolerance. Now, they say, you know, that there's warning labels.
Well, you know, the best way to get a kid interested in your product is to put a warning label on it. And there's actually a fair amount of data to support that idea. This whole notion of forbidden fruit is very appealing to teens. But what I find so troubling about this response from the industry, in fact, when I first heard the response that this is not being marketed to these children, I literally stammered. I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, are you really telling me that? Because, you know, these drinks, they're on MySpace. They're sponsoring extreme sporting events. They're given away at these events for free. And they have names, you know, Spike Shooter and Amp and Monster and Full Throttle. I mean, these drinks are clearly appealing to a certain age child. And if you look at the data, after the age of 24, consumption of these drinks really drops off.
Well, and you wonder, too, if the companies are saying that they recognize that they may be dangerous for kids, why aren't they regulated?
I think this is a tricky territory because all of the ingredients, you know, I think the answer is, well, why don't we regulate a cup of Starbucks? And Starbucks has got a lot of caffeine in it, too. I think this is more one of those things where you're going to have to, as a parent, take some responsibility for this and know what your kids are drinking. What's really scary is some of them are being sold mixed with alcohol. So these drinks are being branded as non-alcoholic beverages that kids are getting very interested in, but then some of these beverages also are being sold with alcohol in mixers by some of the beer companies. So, you know, you do have that worry. And I just think as a parent, you have to be aware of this. Who is giving the kids the money to buy these drinks? They're not cheap. I think parents are thinking Gatorade, and this is not Gatorade. I mean, this is not something to replace sweat that you lost out on the field. This is a heavily caffeinated, sugary beverage with lots of other things in it.
That's Tara Parker Pope. She wrote about energy drinks in her Well column and blog for the New York Times. Tara, thanks for talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Americans send about 250 million tons of trash to landfills every year. Most of it's biodegradable waste, but there's also stuff we throw out that someone else may want. And there's plenty of places to find out if they do. You can put an ad in the paper. There's Craigslist, eBay, FreeCycle, to name a few. And across the country, and in producer Rebecca Shear's state of Alaska, there's another way. All you need is a phone and a radio.
Welcome to Tradio, everyone. Yes, it's a beautiful, gorgeous day. Might as well have a yard sale or a garage sale or something like that. Call us up. If you're looking to sell something, this is the place to come. If you're looking to buy something, hey, this is the place to be. And it doesn't cost a dime.
It's called Tradio. That's T-R-A-D-I-O. Get it? Tradio? Tradio? And you can hear versions of it on radio stations across the country. In Alaska, at least half a dozen stations, both commercial and public, have their own tradios, including this one.
274-KBYR. That's 274-5297.
Smart Radio AM 700 KBYR, where it's hosted by this guy.
My name is Justin McDonald. I'm the general manager of Smart Radio AM 700. I'm also the host of Tradio on Saturdays from noon to 2.
Here's how it works. You tune in.
Okay, we're in it. We're rolling. We're taking phone calls.
You call in.
Let's go to Rick. He's online, too. Rick, welcome to Tradio.
You announce what you've got.
I've got a 20-inch caloric propane stove.
You give out your number.
Okay, well, where are you calling from, by the way?
From the Valley.
And what's your phone number?
And ideally, people will call you up and make an offer. Justin compares Tradio to Craigslist, the free online classified service. And most Tradios do have a web component as well, allowing people to post their ads online. But whether you post, phone, email, snail mail, or fax, you get all sorts of items offered up. Top of the list, on KBYR anyway.
A lot of cars.
From the more common.
Got a 85 Chevy Astro van.
To the less common.
I got a 1995 FedEx box truck.
Boats are big too, says Justin, along with tires and some items that Craig and his list do not allow.
I've got a Ruger Super Blackhawk 44 Magnum revolver.
Firearms.
Yes. You talked about cars being popular. We get a lot of people looking for rare firearms and a lot of people selling firearms.
As for more atypical items.
There were guard goats.
I'm sorry, guard goats?
Yes, guard goats. Yes, like watch goats. That was a bit of an odd one.
Jake Thompson hosts Tradio on KSRM in Kenai. The show made headlines in 2003 when another odd one was called in. An Appaloosa named Apache, who, as it turned out, was stolen. Soon after, the Sterling-based thieves were arrested for second-degree theft and criminal trespass.
On one end, that is kind of a good side of Tradio is, you know, if there is a stolen item and someone does try to sell it on Tradio, you know, they're announcing it to a couple thousand people.
They're like, hey, arrest me.
Basically, yeah. Inevitably, someone's going to know.
It sounds funny, sure, but in a way, the Apache incident speaks volumes about what makes Tradio so special.
It's very much a community show. I mean, we have, like, our regular callers, our regular buyers. You know, and it also comes out, there's a lot of, like, public service that happens on it. Like, when people lose their animals, you know, or when they find someone else's animal, you get a lot of public announcements on it.
In Alaska, Tradio's been around since the 1970s, when KFAR launched a show called Swap and Sell, later renamed Tradio. Nationally, many in the industry believe that Tradio got its start in the 50s, when an appliance store owner in Texas started buying airtime to read the for sale notices pinned to the bulletin board in his shop. So Tradio's always been about fostering community. And Jake Thompson says that here in Alaska, that's especially important.
Here, you know, there's smaller communities, greater distance between people. And so, whereas not everyone's going to know what you have for sale just by seeing it, or driving by your place, they would, you know, get to hear about it on Tradio.
And the cool thing that I like about Tradio and other swap and sell shows around the state of Alaska is they work. They actually work because radio is still a very big thing here in Alaska because a lot of communities depend on that, and I think it's just neat.
So neat, in fact, that Justin McDonald and his KBYR crew might soon follow the lead of other Tradios in the state and make theirs a daily show, so listeners can buy and sell even more of their stuff over the radio.
It's Tradio, friends. A place where you can buy and sell stuff absolutely free. Don't forget us next week, okay? Have a good one.
For more on Tradio, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Rebecca Shear produced our story in Juneau, Alaska. Coming up, the state of men's tennis in the U.S. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The legendary rivalry resumes is the headline on the front page of the Boston Globe today. Lakers and Celtics will finally settle things, says the LA Times. It's game one of the 2008 NBA Finals, the first time the two teams have met up in the championship since 1987. Earlier this week, we talked to Boston homer Bob Ryan. Today, Joel Myers. He's the Lakers play-by-play announcer. He's here in Boston for the game tonight. Joel, how do you see this matchup?
Well, I think it boils down to the two guys that make the biggest plays. Who's going to hit the biggest shots? Well, it's either going to be KG or Kobe.
Well, you've got Kobe Bryant, three NBA championships, two scoring titles, a future Hall of Famer, but he can't do it alone.
Yeah, but he's the best finisher in the game. He's the best closer in the game. And when you say he can't do it alone, if he wants to, he basically can. He is that good.
And Kevin Garnett, you mentioned KG on the Celtics, all heart and determination. But then there's also Paul Pierce, who's waited 10 years for a chance at a title. He's, of course, the Boston player who was stabbed and almost killed at a Boston nightclub a few years ago. He had an attitude that he's completely turned around. How do you see him tonight?
Well, who wants a bigger shot? Is it KG? Is it Paul? It may be Paul Pierce, but for the most part, I don't think there's any doubt that the offense is eventually going to go through KG at the end of the game, so it's up to him to make the bigger shots.
You got Bill Russell, Jerry West, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and now, you know, Kobe Bryant, Paul Pierce. How much are you feeling that when you come to a game?
Well, I think it's great for the league, but as Magic Johnson and Larry Bird said on a conference call a couple of days ago when they dealt with the media, that none of those guys are going to be scoring any points, and it's about the players today. So it's great to look back, and it was a golden decade, where the resurrection of the league as far as I'm concerned, when Magic Johnson and Larry Bird came into the NBA. But I don't know how much it means to these two teams right now. Mm-hmm. I think it's exceptional, though, for the NBA and overall what it could mean for down-the-road purposes.
Bringing more fans to the game. And just your thoughts on the resurrection of these two teams. Last year, the Lakers had to deal with Kobe wanting to be traded, and the Celtics were in last place. Amazing for both teams that here they are now.
It's funny the march the Lakers have been through. There have been great droughts for the Lakers. I can understand why the Celtics feel great about this, and I think everybody in the league feels good for them and some really good people like Doc Rivers, who I like a lot and I'm really happy for, because it's been 21 years, let's face it, since the Celtics were in this position. It's just nice to see a team from the East this competitive.
Oh, Joel Myers, you don't really mean that it's nice to see the Celtics in this position. You're from L.A.
No, if it was up to me, it'd be the old days, and the Lakers and Celtics would face each other about five or six times a season, because I enjoy coming back to Boston that much. I brought my whole family here. I wanted the boys to experience it with me. This is one of my favorite places in the universe.
Joel Myers, the Lakers play-by-play announcer, first game of the NBA Finals is tonight. Joel, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
And as I've been saying, we'll see how long that spirit lasts. Now we turn from the basketball court to the red clay courts of tennis. In the French Open yesterday, Russian Dinara Safina was down 2-5 in the second set to come back and win for the second time in a row, advancing to the semifinals. On the men's side, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal have both advanced to the semifinals. And notice how American men and women are absent from that lineup. Our colleague Bill Littlefield says American tennis fans are pining for the days when the U.S. had the top players in the world. He recently spoke with three former American tennis stars, John McEnroe, Pete Sampras, and Jim Courier, and asked them about the state of men's tennis in the U.S. Courier went first. He told Bill it's a big challenge.
I think that is a big topic of conversation for us. I think that we all recognize the genius of Roger Federer right now and how challenging that is for everybody in the men's game who's trying to get to number one. And obviously, as Americans, we would love to see another one of us reach the pinnacle, and hopefully it will at some point. But for now, Federer's been too tough.
John McEnroe, himself number one in 1980 and from 1981 through 1984, has gone beyond hoping. He's suggested to the U.S. Tennis Association a plan to remedy the situation.
And I've long pushed for the idea of a tennis academy at the National Tennis Center, a real vibrant tennis academy. I've called it the John McEnroe Tennis Academy or Tennis Center because I believe that I could inspire the kids in a way that I was inspired when I was younger. And I think kids need that, especially with all the choices out there.
The choices include other sports, of course. More and more children are specializing in more and more sports at earlier and earlier ages. But is collecting promising young and very young athletes into a tennis center where they could be inspired necessarily the way to develop a number one player? Pete Sampras, who was number one in the world from 1993 until 1998, doesn't think so.
It's an individual sport. You know, what I did on my own. I didn't have really any USGA help. I didn't go to Ball Terry's. Like, I just kind of did on my own. I was a little bit of fortune in that, a little bit of luck. But I can't pinpoint one thing why there's not a number one American in the world, and it just sort of goes in cycles.
Nick Bollettieri, founder of the Florida Academy, to which Pete Sampras did not move, begs to differ. He claims he's got the numbers to prove that working with kids who leave home to concentrate on tennis at his academy produces results. though he acknowledges the competition is tougher these days.
Back in the 80s and the early 90s, the United States was the leader. I had 27 people in the main draw at the U.S. Open, and Curry was one of them with Agassi and Hasselish and everybody else. However, the rest of the world has caught up with us, and not only in tennis, but it caught up with us in basketball and soccer and golf and every other sport.
Bollettieri's recipe for success is to get tennis rackets into the hands of 5- and 6-year-olds, work on the fundamentals with those children until they're 12 or 13, and then funnel them into increasingly competitive situations where they will, in his words, beat the crap out of each other and reach their potential. He feels having the number one male player in the world would provide a significant catalyst to the growth of the game in the U.S.
Number ones and number two should be an inspiration to everybody. But when you have somebody from your country, I believe that's the way that's got to be. I don't believe that a champion from Ethiopia is going to inspire our kids to go out and be tennis players. I believe the influence has got to come from where you are, where you're born, and everything else. That's my opinion.
John McEnroe, who played high school soccer and basketball and considers himself better for the experience, might argue with Nick Bollettieri's theories about immersion in tennis. Come to think of it, current number one Roger Federer attributes his excellent footwork to his experience as a young soccer player. And Pete Sampras, he says he's less concerned about the citizenship of the number one male player in the world than he is delighted by the quality of play evident when Roger Federer defends his spot atop the ranking.
I'm a big fan of Roger. I'm a big fan of Roddick and Blake. I think they're great players, but you know, Roger certainly has a certain class about him that's incredible. He's a great player. I love watching Nadal, sort of tenacious, and he's a great competitor. So I'm a tennis fan, but just being around the sport and seeing the big picture, I think the media and the fans, they want to see that U.S. Open winner be an American. It's just tough. They're playing against one of the best players of all time.
Sounds a little like what tennis fans everywhere but the U.S. might have been saying to themselves and each other from 1993 until 1998, when Pete Sampras himself relinquished the number one spot.